Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
Birds of prey, known as raptors, have fascinated mankind for thousands of years. They were revered as gods by ancient Egyptians, adopted as national symbols and displayed on coins, and now are mascots of sporting teams. Bruce Hawk has spent nearly five decades studying wild raptors and has authored four raptor-related books, one about the sport of falconry, another about prairie falcons, which are found only in North America. He photographed birds of prey for a coloring book. Bruce Hawk's latest book is perhaps the definitive book on a small bird of prey called a merlin. He is editor and chief contributor to this book, Magical Merlins. Bruce Hawk, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be with you.
Now, I'm just imagining a listener out there saying, did she say his last name is Hawk?
Yeah, that's correct. And we live in Eagle, Idaho, off Floating Feather Lane, so there's a lot of bird references here.
But now, they might not understand that your last name is not spelled like the bird.
Right. It's a Dutch-German variation, H, two A's and a K.
So if somebody wanted to Google you, they would look it up under H-A-A-K.
That's correct, yes.
Well, now, I did my own little survey here in California, and I asked people if they were familiar with the word merlin. And all these people said, well, there was this magician, a part of the King Arthur legend, and there was one person who knew the other meaning of merlin. And he was a French friend from Brittany, which is across the English Channel from the UK. So you can probably understand why he might know this term as a small dark falcon.
The origin of the modern word merlin is actually from a French word, which is spelled slightly different, but it's been used in the English literature for, I think, you know, some decades or centuries at this point in time. But yeah, it refers to this small falcon that was very popular for falconry back in the Middle Ages, and so that's the root of the word of merlin.
And I'll remind listeners, the title of your most recent book, Magical Merlins. So you kind of played on that idea that, yeah, there was this magician named Merlin, but these are, and your cover, of course, makes it obvious that these are birds.
Oh, sure.
Because you have a lovely cover. And you did so many of the photographs in your book. So this, I found so fascinating that this name that we call the name of this little bird is from Old French. And then the other merlin is a word from Welsh origin. So even though they're spelled the same, they have two different origins.
Absolutely. And the merlin, you know, is a small migratory falcon that lives only in the northern hemisphere, and there's nine subspecies of them worldwide. So they probably go by a lot of local names, you know, between North America and Europe and Asia and the Far East. So
What you were just saying somewhat gave me a clue as to, for example, there's a best-selling book here in Chico by an ornithologist. It's The Birds of Bidwell Park. Bidwell Park is one of the largest municipal parks here in the United States, and he does not include a merlin in his book. So if people wanted to say, oh, I think I'll go out in Bidwell Park and look for a merlin, and what would you say?
Well, the chances of seeing one there, or depending on where that is, are probably fairly low. The merlins that we see particularly in the western U.S., almost all are breeders in the boreal forest of Canada and Alaska, and so they migrate down into the lower 48 during the winter. But there are lots of merlins in California during the winter, so it's not impossible to see them. In fact, right around Chico, I'm sure a number of them are wintering there in the valley in the agricultural areas.
Well, I appreciated the fact that you have a map toward the end of your book. In your last chapter, you have a book with colors indicating where the breeding grounds are, where they're found year-round, non-breeding. And so I really appreciate maps to help me locate these little birds that you've written about in your book. So you might describe this map to listeners since they can't see it.
Well, sure. Well, it's basically a map of North America, and it shows the breeding range, which historically has been mostly north of the lower 48 in Canada and Alaska. But now what's happened is merlins are expanding their breeding range to the south, and on the Pacific side of the Cascades and Rockies, they're breeding down into places like Olympia, Washington, and even have been found down along the Columbia River, some in eastern Idaho, and more frequently towards the Plain States, southern Wyoming east. They've also moved down on the East Coast into Pennsylvania and West Virginia, and this, you know, was not recorded previously. One of the problems with studying merlins is that they were hit very hard during the DDT era, similar to peregrine falcons, bald eagles, and brown pelicans. But the real problem is that there are no before and after comparisons, as merlins were just off the radar and not studied intently prior to the DDT era. So what we're showing now is the after effects and the changes in their behavior and their population structure since DDT was mostly eliminated from our environment.
My guest is Bruce Haack, H-A-A-K, and he's written a book about birds of prey. The title of the book is Magical Merlins. And I thought it was interesting you tell us how you happened to start investigating merlin ecology. And how did that come about, Bruce?
Well, I've been studying birds, as you mentioned at the outset of the program, for about 50 years now. And in the late 1990s, I did a cooperative study with the late Dr. Leon Powers at NNU, Northwest Nazarene University in Nampa, Idaho. And we were radio tagging Cooper's hawks and sharpshin hawks for a study with their students. And we kept running into merlins while we were driving around. And I'd always been told that merlins were an open country bird and that you should go to the feedlots and the dairies. And then we started finding them right in the middle of towns. So it was Dr. Powers that got me thinking that, well, you know, you can find all the wildlife you want in urban areas now. You don't have to go to wilderness. So that kind of springboarded the study of merlins a few years later. In fact, in 2005, they were put on the list of species of conservation concern in Idaho, and that's what launched my investigation into wintering merlins in southwest Idaho. The Department of Fish and Game tried to quantify all the lesser-known species of wildlife, and because there wasn't much known about merlins, they put them on the list, and I went into the office and said, well, folks, there's lots of them, and the person doing the listing said, oh, yeah, prove it. So I started driving around southwest Idaho in the Boise River Valley, and every time I'd find a merlin, I would try to identify it as to age, sex, and subspecies. And then later I started trapping and banding and collecting biological data off the dozens of merlins that I captured and compared that data with just my visual assessment. And it turned out that my identification in the field was pretty good because it pretty much matched the information that we had from trapping the birds and handling very close range.
Well, you were saying you were out, and I was kind of surprised that in North America, they tend to be more urban, these little birds.
Well,
whereas
they do
in
now.
Europe, mm-hmm. Not necessarily in Europe, but that's the case here, you say.
Yes, yeah. It's very interesting to me that DDT hit, birds worldwide. It wasn't limited to North America. And when the peregrines bounced back in both Europe and North America, because based a lot on the release of captive birds, they became urban-oriented. Now, in Europe, Merlins are still not urban oriented. They tend to breed out on the moors and open areas. And in places like Ireland, they breed along the edges of the tree plantations that were planted in the open bog areas. But in North America, surprisingly, the resurrection of the Merlin was keyed on urban areas, particularly the first big breeding population was known was Saskatoon up in Saskatchewan in Canada. And now they've moved back down in the west, started pretty much around Bellingham and then down to the North Seattle suburbs, and they're moving south now. And what's interesting is we have lots of Merlins wintering in the Boise area, but they don't nest here. And so I keep wondering if, you know, some of these birds are eventually just going to stay because there's plenty of food and plenty of trees.
My guest is Bruce Hawk, and his book is Magical Merlins. He also has a coloring book, photographs and drawings to color the colorful lives of birds of prey. And I'm assuming that you invite anybody of any age to enjoy this coloring book, Bruce, because you say, color them like you want to.
Absolutely. Yeah, these are 30 of my original photos, and an artist friend of mine did the line drawings, and we thought, well, this is the perfect opportunity to show people what bird of prey actually look like when they can identify them on one page, and then there's a line drawing on the opposite page that they can color. So people who like to doodle, or, you know, if you have kids in the family that like to color, this is a good way for them to see the actual color of the birds and put that on paper.
You just mentioned identifying. So in this book, of course, you have the photograph and then the line drawing to be colored. But now what about you go out in the field? Is it easy to identify these Merlins in the field?
No, it's difficult. And it's difficult for most people to identify birds of prey. And that's why I put a little bio blurb with each photo in the coloring book. And that tells them, well, is it a hawk, a falcon, or an owl? And gives them a little information on the natural history, maybe how it got its name, how it lives, and if there's any ecological problems that the species is having.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think we should know about Merlins ourselves, just the general person, general population?
Well, I think, you know, people who are interested in wildlife, and particularly birders,
just
need to grasp that these are just a little falcon that is very inconspicuous. And one of the things that makes them difficult to identify in the field is that they have these three different plumage colorations and intergrades in between them. But they also are birds of habit. So where you find one in a perch, or might be their favorite hunting perch, a lot of times, if you go back over the course of the day, they'll be back in that tree or on that stand or snag. And you can actually observe them at pretty close range because they're very tolerant of people.
Well, what kind of problems do you see in the future for this little bird, this Merlin?
Well, I think any time an animal moves into an urban environment, you know, that's a new set of potential problems. I mean, I guess on the plus side, what people have created over the last 100 years, particularly in the Western U.S., is habitats that have trees and shrubs with lots of natural food for songbirds, which are their main prey. And then there's a year-round source of water that didn't used to exist. So a lot of birds that would come from the far north and bypass places like Southern Idaho to just keep going south can now shortstop and stay here during the winter. And so the year-round food and water helps them stay farther north, which reduces their migration time when they want to go back to far north to breed. And in most urban areas, you know, people aren't shooting birds of prey like was historically done at some pretty high levels. And so they're pretty well protected that way. On the downside, we also have red-tailed hawks and Cooper's hawks that have moved into the same environment, and they can be potential predators on the Merlin. So kind of a two-edged sword that way.
You've told us a bit about Merlins, for example, that more are found in towns and cities than out in the country. And I liked your sentence when you referred to a nature deficit disorder. And I think, yeah, I understand that. We have a nature deficit disorder, particularly maybe younger people. So I like your sentence when you say, especially for children, nature centers, natural history museums, and hands-on wildlife educational opportunities provide them experiences, often combined with physical exercise, that are preferable to weekends spent in front of a computer screen.
Well, that's it's a little preachy, but having worked in environmental interpretation, and I helped build one of the facilities at the Peregrine Friends World Center for Birds of Prey here in Boise, and you know, they have thousands of people that come through their center every year and learn about birds of prey. And of course, one of the show places in Southwest Idaho is the Morley Nelson Snake River Birds of Prey area, which is the Snake River Canyon south of Cuna, Idaho. And that's where in the spring they'll get up to 200 pairs of nesting prairie falcons in the canyon. And so I was able to do some educational tours out there over the years. And I had actually studied prairie falcons in graduate school, so that's a species that's near and dear to my heart.
Well, I'd like to leave listeners with this, what you were just saying. In your book, you make the point that a goal of conservation should be education. So thank you for helping educate us about these birds of prey, Bruce.
Well, it's my pleasure entirely.
My guest has been Bruce Haack, spelled H-A-A-K, and his book, he was editor and chief contributor to Magical Merlins, and he also did the photography in a book, a coloring book, called The Colorful Lives of Birds of Prey. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
After a short break, I'll be back with guests who've written a book about the birds of Bidwell Park. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Today's two guests collaborated on a locally popular field guide to the birds of Bidwell Park. They have now expanded this book, their new edition, The Birds of Bidwell Park. Retired Professor Roger Lederer taught ornithology and ecology at Chico State University and served as dean of the College of Natural Sciences for 10 years. He has birdwatched in over 100 countries and lectured on numerous cruise ships. He has presented hundreds of public presentations to a wide variety of audiences, and through his website, ornithology.com, has been a resource for the BBC, National Geographic, National Public Radio, Canadian Television, Vanity Fair, the Guinness Book of World Records, and many other organizations. Professor Lederer has published 30 scientific papers and 8 books. His most recent book is Beaks, Bones, and Birdsongs. Roger Lederer, welcome.
Thank you.
The illustrator for the Birds of Bidwell Park is retired Professor Carol Burr. She taught literature at California State University, Chico, served as department chair, created the honors program, and directed the Center for Multicultural and Gender Studies. She edited and published Unstill Lives, Women of Northern California, and Feeling for Place. She has worked in oil, watercolor, and charcoal. She drew the birds and symbols of the Birds of Bidwell Park using pen and pencil. She's involved in many local organizations, such as the League of Women Voters, Soroptimist International, the Discovery Shop, and is the longest-serving member, over 20 years, of Bidwell Park's Watch Program. Carol Burr, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you believe in taking care of the park, obviously, if you've been a member of Bidwell Park's Watch Program for over 20 years.
Yeah, I got in fairly early. It's 20 years now, but it's a group of volunteers that come in, and we go through a training process, and we learn the rules of the park, and then we also clean up litter, and just our face of the park. We wear our little vests, and we have no police function, obviously, sort of an educational and a cleanup function, which is something we really care about in the park. And we also did that Make a Difference Day. We cleaned up in the park as well with that as part of Park Watch. And it fits in with everything that we've done sort of with the book and with our careers.
Well, a lot of us appreciate the fact that Annie Bidwell is the person responsible for this wonderful attraction, this wonderful asset to the community of Chico.
Absolutely.
In fact, you dedicate the book to Annie Bidwell.
Yeah, she understood, I think, the importance of open space. And to have 4,000 acres as a city park is pretty spectacular. And it's a beautiful park. It's under a lot of pressure because we all want to use it. So I think part of what she was trying to do by saying no alcohol and some of the other rules that she created for it were so that everyone could enjoy it generation after generation. So we feel she was kind of a founding mother in many, many ways, but the park is one of the main ones. And she really understood stewardship. And so you love something, but you try not to love it to death, I guess.
Well, we all are grateful to Annie Bidwell for that. So you dedicate your book to Annie. What was the inspiration for this collaboration?
Well, I think for years I've been trying to figure out a way to collaborate with my husband.
Roger Lederer is your husband.
Oh, yes, by the way. Yeah. That's sort of how I got to be the artist, because it was, you know, kind of sitting on the sofa figuring out how we were going to get the book illustrated. But I've been looking for something like this, and even though illustrating a bird book was not what I had thought of, I don't think I ever would have come up with that on my own. I'm not even sure that I quite survived doing this thing. You know, it was really something different for me. But, yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting when the humanities and the sciences get together.
Well, you are the illustrator, but there is one illustration that is not yours. All the rest of the illustrations you did.
That's true.
Who was the, may I call her the guest illustrator?
I think that's appropriate. She's also the legacy because she's our granddaughter, and Olivia Calvin, and she is quite a little artist herself. We started drawing together when she was very, very young. And I think I credit her to some extent with my even considering doing some of the drawing for the book, because she, you know, when you're with a little person and you're trying to find something interesting to do, that's what you do. And we just had such a good time together. And she is the next generation, and we want the park to be there for her and all the Olivias out there.
My guests are Carol Burr and Roger Lederer, and they one of the first pages of your book is an illustration by your granddaughter, Olivia.
Yeah.
How old was she when she did that illustration? Because it's quite nice.
She was nine.
Nine years old.
Yeah.
And already a published illustrator.
Oh, and she's very proud of it. She likes to show every time we bring the book out. She says, you know, here I am. Yeah.
Well, I was looking at your original edition, your first edition, and your new edition to see, well, in what way did you expand this book? And I noticed that in the back of the book, you have other birds you might see. And in the original edition, you had you changed it, in other words, from the first edition to the newer edition.
Mm-hmm.
And in what ways did you change the birds you might see?
Well,
I
think
did you add to it? Did
yes.
you subtract from it?
We didn't subtract because the birds that we have in there are the ones you're still likely to see. But we added five additional birds that have become really much more common in the park. I mean, you might see them rarely, but now we're seeing them much more commonly.
Well, I wondered, too, if you got feedback from local residents who said, hey, Carol, I see a lot of this bird, or did you just on your own see these?
I would say it's more on our own, wouldn't you, that we just...
We did. We given a lot of bird walks over the years to, for the Snow Goose Festival and for other events. And people point out, well, I saw this or I saw that. But on our field trips, and it was probably, certainly dozens, maybe 100 field trips that we've taken people out, there's only been three birds that people observe during our field trips that aren't in the book. And they've only been observed once. We put one of them in. That's the great egret. We saw a great egret, and that wasn't even in the park. It just flew over, but somebody wanted to make a point. You don't have that in your book.
Well, I did notice that you included more in your descriptions. You had more birds. In the first edition, you had 86 species described, and then in your 2017 edition, you have 91 species described.
Yes.
So that meant you did some more illustrations, Carol.
Yes, I did five more. I did the, as he mentioned, the great egret, which flew over. We did a downy woodpecker, and we have seen some of those, but they're not really very common. A Nashville warbler, a phainopepla, which is the common name and the official name are the same, and the Eurasian collared dove. This one that arrived in Chico around 2007 or so and has proliferated. And now they're just everywhere, making that very distinctive call that they have.
Maybe we could also mention from one edition to the next, since you used a local publisher.
Very much so. We're delighted with Heidelberg Press. And Larry Jackson took extremely good care of us, because it took a lot of sort of, rearranging of the book with the addition of the birds, and we also redid all the text. And so it was a big project for him, and he did a beautiful job.
He did, and I looked at what we gave him and his setup, and I thought I felt sorry for him, actually, because this is going to be a lot of work, but he was just so good at it. And he caught all kinds of things, and he had to rejigger all the page numbers and all that stuff, and he did it with aplomb. He was great.
Yes, and he actually seemed to enjoy it.
Well, speaking of enjoying, I thoroughly enjoy, Roger, your lectures that I've been to. They are just so fascinating and captivating, particularly, I'm sure people who know a lot about birds enjoy them, but I learned so much. And one thing that people sometimes wonder about, how are animals different from humans? And in the case, since we're talking about birds, I like the quote by Robert Lind that you included in your book. Do you remember what he said about how birds differ from man?
Yeah, birds can have their environment and not destroy it, something like that.
Yeah, he says, there's nothing in which the birds differ more from man. Now, people might say, well, birds can't talk, or that's a difference. But he said, there's nothing in which birds differ more from man than the way in which they can build and yet leave a landscape as it was before.
Hmm. Right. Everything recycles in their world.
There you go. Native Americans understood that.
Yeah.
And I think we're realizing that if we don't figure it out pretty quickly, we are going to be not doing very well, because the animals, and of course we're animals too, but we seem to be doing a bad job with the other animals. Yeah.
My guests are Roger Lederer. He's an ornithologist and author of 8 books and many scientific papers, and Carol Burr, whose skills with English language come in handy. You had a previous book, Latin for Bird Lovers, and the two of you collaborated on that book, which was fascinating. For example, speaking of where names for birds come from, I somehow, even though I know the Greek word os is bone, because we have all these English words that we've taken from the Greek, I never thought about an osprey as being related to the Greek word for bone. And how did that come about? Why is an osprey called?
Bonebreaker.
Bonebreaker, yeah.
Yeah, they only eat fish. And, they grab a fish and pull it up to its nest and then tear it apart. And there's all kinds of bones at the bottom of the nest, and that could be where it came from. And ospreys are found all over the world. So a lot of people had different names for them. But the basic Greek name, osprey, is what they're stuck with.
And you mentioned they're eating fish. They're very successful fishermen, fisher birds. You say that 30% of the time they catch a fish.
Right, one of every three times. I showed one movie in the, I taught an OLLI course, the OSHA lifelong learning thing last spring. And I showed one clip of an osprey, and he was fighting with the fish. He was actually in the water, and for about 2 minutes, you couldn't see anything but the bird on top of the water and some kind of fish underneath. He finally gets up with what looked like a 5-pound trout. It was incredible.
Yeah.
Well, he's also successful because he's very clever in how he fishes.
Yeah, well, you mean how he carries the fish once he has it in the air, which
yeah.
I think is quite striking, that ability to rotate that toe so he has two in the front and two in the back. Huh?
Yeah, because we assume, I guess, if we don't pay attention, that all birds' feet look alike. And you mentioned that some birds, their talons, they differ from one another according to what they need mm-hmm. when they're in their environment. Now, since the very first illustration in your book is of a woodpecker, your granddaughter, Olivia Calvin, did this illustration of an acorn woodpecker. Mm. And woodpeckers I find fascinating. There are all sorts of interesting facts you include about woodpeckers. For example, if they're pecking on a tree trunk, you mentioned, Carol, the talons, and you think, well, most birds, they sit on a perch that's horizontal. But there's that woodpecker. His perch is vertical.
Mm-hmm.
So how does he manage that?
Well, he's got two toes in front and two toes in back, and then he leans back against his tail feathers, which are real stiff, very stiff tail feathers, and just lean back and pry themselves against the tail feathers and pound. And they can pound into a tree with 1,200 Gs of force. Imagine 1,200 Gs of force. I mean, astronauts maybe undergo 3 or 4 Gs. I mean, that's the 1,200 times the force of gravity, and they can do that by just leaning against their feathers and hanging on with their feet.
I didn't remember that particular figure, but in your book, you may not have included. I do remember the toes and the tail he uses, but my goodness.
I may not have put all that in there because there's an awful lot
of
woodpeckers.
And you're very concise. I love that about your book. It is very concise. When you're reading about the woodpecker, each bird is about a page. So you squeeze in a lot of information.
The hardest part of writing the book is just trying to figure out what the most interesting things are in the shortest number of words.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think in that regard, your task was maybe harder than Carol's because she says, okay, I'm just going to illustrate the male of each of these species.
No, she had the harder job.
There were days
she was sitting on the couch drawing. What was that? It was the red shoulder hawk, and I thought we're going to have to commit her.
That was a tough one. Yeah, but it's okay. But I mean, I think what we found when we went back too is to just to make things as pellucidly clear as possible so that you can get in there and you know, have 10 sentences or 20 sentences and feel as though, okay, I really feel like I've got a better handle on identifying the bird I just saw.
And you mentioned that this is a guide for beginners, really, that if people want more information, there are other sources, other guidebooks. So yes. I think if I were reading along about this woodpecker, I think, my gosh, woodpeckers are so interesting. I'm going to go to other resources and learn more about the woodpecker. Well, the fact that woodpeckers, this tremendous force that you described, Roger, why don't they give themselves a concussion?
Well, three things. One is that their lower jaw acts a little bit like a shock absorber. It springs back and forth, so that absorbs some of the shock. Secondly, their brain case is a lot like a sponge, and so it moves around and absorbs some of that shock. And the third thing is they have a tongue bone that wraps around the top of their head, and the tongue bone acts like a safety belt to keep their head from moving back so far. In fact, they've invented tank helmets for tank drivers and bicycle helmets based on the woodpecker skull, and they've just invented something not on the market yet, but a collar for football players to prevent their neck from snapping back.
So it
all based on the woodpecker.
That really is amazing, these adaptations that this particular bird has. You mentioned this special mechanism, their jaw, and the fact their toes have adapted to how they need to be perched on and their stiff tail feathers. But then also, if a human were working close with wood like that and chips are flying, we'd have to have goggles or a mask. And a woodpecker doesn't have that. What does he have to keep from breathing in
wood chips? Well, they've got little bristles over their nose and near their eyes to keep wood chips from hitting their eyes.
So they have their own
little masks, sort of,
to protect them. So they can hold themselves in place with their toes and their tail. And there's another thing that they have to protect themselves from besides the wood chips, and that's parasites. How do they protect themselves from parasites?
Well, it's not only woodpeckers, but a lot of
flickers
do it. A lot of birds do that, too, is they just sit on an anthill, and the ants will crawl all over them. And I've got some pictures, some movies of a robin doing this, and he just spreads his wings out, ants crawl all over him, and then they crush the ants in their feathers after the ants get all over him. And that puts the formic acid from the ants onto their feathers, which presumably keeps away bugs, mites and ticks and things like that.
Yeah.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with ornithologist Roger Lederer and the illustrator of their book, The Birds of Bidwell Park, Dr. Carol Burr. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Today, we're talking about birds, and my two guests have collaborated on a book about the birds of Bidwell Park. That's ornithologist Roger Lederer and illustrator Carol Burr. A bird that we can recognize when we see it circling overhead, those of us who don't know much about birds, and we see these birds circling overhead, and we think, oh, there must be something dead. And you say, no, that's not why vultures circle.
No, when the vultures are circling around, and they do that this time of year, especially when they're migrating, they'll find an air current and they rest by circling around. And they may be looking for food, but if there were dead food down there and they smelled it, they'd be down there. They wouldn't be circling around. And a common term for this vultures circling around as if they're being stirred is a kettle of vultures.
Uh-huh.
I think it's an interesting term. But, yeah people think, oh, yeah, there's something dead down there. No, they're dead down there. You wouldn't see them circling.
They'd be down there feasting.
Yeah.
Well, if they feast on something like a dead skunk and a predator comes along, they've got a full stomach. What did they do?
They throw up. And that's why their name is Cathartes. For the word, catharsis, to throw up. But some people say it's catharsis. It's not because they throw up when they get frightened and have been eating a big meal and can't take off, but because they clean the environment. So they clean the environment of various kinds of dead things.
So we owe a debt of gratitude to vultures.
Absolutely.
It is interesting, though, that we assume it's because of the dead animal, but as you say, they're circling because of the conditions are right for soaring.
Right.
And so if they find a dead animal, down they go. The vultures are not the prettiest bird I've ever seen.
No.
Well, having no feathers on their heads gives them kind of a homely look, but since they have their heads in mushy-gushy guts of things, it's better that they do not have feathers because then they'd really have some problem with parasites probably. So it's a way to stay clean, sort of.
So vultures are unattractive, but it's a function of the fact that they've got their head in.
They have redeeming qualities.
They have many redeeming qualities.
Yeah. Well, there's so many interesting things about these birds that you tell us that we see them as having distinct personalities. And that's what I really enjoyed about your book. My gosh, look at this bird that, for example, I love watching crows because I think they probably, if we were to give a prize for the smartest bird, I think a crow would be a candidate for that.
Absolutely.
Just from what I know about crows.
All of them in the crow family. Crows,
jays.
Ravens, jays, mm-hmm. nutcrackers.
Yeah.
Because I've sometimes wondered about the difference in a raven and a crow, because Edgar Allan Poe didn't write the crow, he wrote the raven.
Right.
Well, ravens are bigger. I mean, they're about a third bigger, and they have more, the heavier bill.
Much
and they
heavier.
Have more, their nostrils are covered by hairs that are much heavier. They're just sort of more ominous looking, I think, if, you know.
They also have a little.
If he wrote the crow, it wouldn't be as famous as the raven.
Yeah, quote the crow, nevermore.
Quote the crow, yeah, exactly.
But they do also have a beard, sort of a beard.
And the raven. Beard.
The raven does, yeah. Yes.
Well, the crow itself is such a large bird that it's hard to imagine a bigger bird of that sort, the raven, as you're describing it. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a bird that I thought, well, gosh, that sounds pretty dumb, and that's the brown towhee, because he attacks his own reflection.
Well, a lot of birds do that, and especially in the springtime, I get emails from people saying, I've got cardinals. It's mostly cardinals, bluebirds, robins. But a lot of birds will attack their reflection in a rearview mirror or in your house, you know, anything like that. They just think it's a competitor, and so they charge it, and they keep hitting the window and can't seem to learn it's them.
Yeah, they're actually trying to make windows so that the birds do not see their reflection, because a lot of birds actually have killed themselves by running into windows. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes me sad when I see a bird. Most of them, they're just stunned.
Right.
And they, after a little bit, they get up and can fly away. And so the crow, we often see on PBS documentaries about crows and how clever they are with tools. But there's also, you say the green heron uses bait when they fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple herons do that, and I think a couple of other birds do, too. They just hold a piece of whatever it happens to be, drop it in the water, and some fish come to it. We were in, where were we, someplace off the coast of West Africa one time and watching this black hawk, and he was circling around. He was dropping things in the water, and I couldn't figure out what he was doing. He was dropping twigs. He'd come down and grab twigs and then fly up in the air and drop the twigs. Well, there were fish coming to the twigs there, and once in a while, he'd drop down to catch a fish.
Yeah.
But he just used twigs. The fish didn't know any better. They'd just take a look, and all of a sudden, it was too late.
My guests are ornithologist Roger Lederer and retired English professor Carol Burr, who was the illustrator of their book, The Birds of Bidwell Park. There's, I think, as fashions come and go, I think we can kind of thank the fact that it went out of fashion to put feathers on a hat.
Yeah, in fact, the great egret that we added in the expanded version, and the other sort of herons and that sort of thing almost were taken down to extinction by the feather trade, huge feather trade, late 19th, early 20th century. And they were just killing these birds by the thousands for their feathers. It was pretty bad, and finally they passed a law, so preventing that. So,
well, also I don't know that we eat that bird, but we eat ducks, and the wood duck was hunted for food and for its feathers, and fortunately, we quit wearing feathers on our hats for their sake. So,
yeah. I think that's the thing. I mean, for a while, it seemed as though people were just sort of shooting them, assuming there was no end to the number. And I think that's what's really changed is our recognition that we have driven birds really very close to and critically endangered. And what is it? What did you tell me? 40% loss of songbirds in the last, what?
40 years.
40 years.
Wow.
So we're seeing a huge depredation of the birds, and it's a loss of habitat, you know, loss of food. Climate change, to some extent, they come at certain times of the year expecting food to be there, and if the climate change has sort of changed that made it come in earlier or later or whatever, then they struggle with that.
Well, I think books like yours raise our awareness of what we're doing to the birds, and the fact that they are such an asset to our way of life that we do need to take care of them. And I think maybe the baby boomers are leading the way
to
bird watching, because a friend of mine here in town said that bird watching is perfect for baby boomers because it's easier on the knees.
I haven't thought about that
part.
No,
we haven't.
But yeah, that's part of the book, or the reason for the book, is to get people interested in birds. When people are interested in birds, it's sort of they're opening the door to nature, to appreciating what's out there. So the people may have been totally out of contact with nature over their life, and then they start to get a little older, look for vocations that they don't have to, you know, not doing extreme skiing anymore. So they start looking at birds, and the birds show them other kinds of things, and so they appreciate nature that they hadn't before.
Well, I know that I am constantly amazed in reading your book at the things I did not know about birds. And they're around us all the time, and I was kind of astounded at my lack of awareness of the birds. Now, I do recognize the scrub jays because they are so ubiquitous, and their screech, I won't call it a bird song, is distinctive.
Yeah, it's not very pretty.
Not quite a song. Same thing with the crows. Crows are songbirds, but not really.
No.
They're a different group of songbirds, but they're officially songbirds.
Not a pretty call.
Do you run into people calling the scrub jays blue jays?
Oh, yeah. Blue jays and then the acorn woodpecker, red-headed woodpeckers.
Yeah, because he does have a red head. The acorn woodpecker has a red head.
And so do all other woodpeckers.
Yeah.
So I was just back east. I was in Florida last week, and I saw the real red-headed woodpecker back there and the red-bellied woodpecker and the fish crow, things we don't have out here, but... So they have all official common English names. It's the only group of animals or only group of organisms in the world that have official English names, all 10,000 species of them. So we call the blue jay, it's wrong because, one, it's not the right name. Two, there is a bird named the blue jay already. So I try and point that out to people. There are official names.
I think when you have people who sort of come to California from the East Coast and they have a bird that sort of looks like what they're seeing out here, so then they keep bringing the blue jay with them, even though that's not really what they're seeing. But it's not a terrible error, I guess.
Well, but it makes us take a closer look.
Very much
if
so.
If we realize, a blue jay and a scrub jay are not the same bird.
Right. I know. And that's why I think having a book that just has the birds that you're likely to see sitting at the window of your, you know, where you're having breakfast or going out for a walk, this is a good place to start, I think.
And you don't need binoculars. In my neighborhood, there was a while that magpies congregated out in front of my house, and I just loved watching them. I didn't need binoculars, and I just wondered about the personalities of these birds that were beautiful.
They are
beautiful.
I find
them really pretty. And to watch them strut around. But I don't see them now. They either found some other place than my neighborhood or they're less common here.
Yes, well, I think they were affected, the magpies.
We had a lot of magpies in our backyard for several years, too, and then they disappeared. It was West Nile virus.
West Nile. Yeah.
Crows and magpies, almost 100% mortality. Magpies are just starting to come back now. They have been coming back the last couple of years, but then not to the extent where they were before.
Yeah, and
there is hope that they might visit.
Oh, I think so. And we, you know, for a while we lost sight of the quail, and I think it's partly because of the feral cats and because they're ground nesting, and so, yeah.
My guests are Roger Lederer, he's an ornithologist and author, and Carol Burr, also an author and illustrator. So I think the more we know about birds, the better stewards we can be. On this planet that we share with these.
One thing is knowing. The second thing is having the money and the political will to implement it.
Well, you've certainly piqued our curiosity about the birds that we can observe here locally. Thank you so much, Roger Lederer.
Thank you.
And Carol Burr. I would also like to thank my first guest, Bruce Hawk, who has written a book about merlins. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Magic powder. I made an appointment to see a local witch doctor because I had an ache in my hip that wouldn't go away. The practitioner's name is actually Daniel, but I use the term witch doctor because, quite simply, I don't know exactly how he does what he does, but I do know that most of the time, whatever he does, it works. I lie on my back, tell him what hurts, and then he pokes and prods my abdomen for a bit. Then he says, "Let's try some proprioception." I do my best to repeat the word. "Pope's conception?" Daniel says it again, but it remains a tongue twister for me, one of those in one ear and then become garbled in the brain sort of terms. According to the good people at WebMD.com, proprioception is the body's ability to sense movement, action, and location, and is probably a word which chiropractors use in daily conversation over coffee. To me, it sounds like part of a mystical incantation that Gandalf might say to gain access to a secret passageway. Daniel, then bends my legs a bit, tells me to push my knees sideways against his hands a few times, and then he massages in some key spots. 30 minutes later, I am on my way, pain-free. So, when he suggests I might consider taking diatomaceous earth to help ease joint pain, I don't hesitate in purchasing a 2-pound bag. If this enchanted white powder is as effective as his proprio spellcasting, well, that's good enough for me. I do know what diatomaceous earth is. It is a fine, odorless white powder made from the crushed, fossilized remains of single-celled aquatic organisms called diatoms. Their cell walls consist of silica, the same chemical that makes up glass. Over a long period of time, diatoms accumulated in the bottoms of rivers, streams, lakes, and oceans. Today, the resulting diatomaceous earth is mined and used in a variety of applications, ranging from pool filters to non-toxic pesticides to toothpaste. I had not, however, heard of food-grade diatomaceous earth, but that's what the package said, so I gave it a go. I tried a tablespoon in water, and the first thing I noticed was that it really doesn't dissolve. Rather, it made the water cloudy for a few minutes and eventually sank to the bottom, so I pretty much needed to stir and drink it right away. It tasted like it looked, like very fine, flavorless grit. I tried it in some orange juice and ended up with gritty orange juice. I couldn't bear the idea of sprinkling it on some food, so I finally settled on mixing it with coffee and disguising the grittiness with some sugar, albeit with minimal success. After a year of drinking gritty coffee, my joints felt, well, they felt a year older than when I started. I knew what had happened. I had the magic powder, but I had never learned the magic words. Though, even if I had, I probably wouldn't have been able to pronounce them properly, and this might have done more harm than good. Jeremy Miller.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.